Welcome to Australia's Fiercely Independent Property Podcast.
Residential property is the only asset class we live in. It is where we raise our families, and it's our most expensive investment, yet property advice remains unregulated.
Listen to three pioneers of the property industry, each with diverse areas of expertise in property planning, buying, and education.
We'll distill the raw truth from the ill-informed.
Join the property planner, David Johnston, the property buyer, Kate Bakos.
That's me.
And the property professor, Peter Kalizos, as we take you on a journey through the maze of property, mortgage and money decisions to empower you to create your ideal lifestyle.
Well, welcome everybody. It's Kate's turn to host again, and it feels like it's been a little while since I've played host. I think you subbed for me a couple of times, Pete. Thank you.
Pleasure.
I'm excited about this one today. It's so good to see you both, even though Dave and I are in the grip of our hardest of hard lockdowns. It is always joyous to catch you guys. It keeps my Wednesdays, you know, there's a peg in the sand. It's recording day. Today is Wednesday. It's nice to keep track of the days. How are you doing, Pete?
I'm very good indeed. Thanks, Kate. I do feel sorry for you in Melbourne and those people in Sydney and parts of the Northern Territory are also in lockdown.
I got ACT as well now.
Yeah, I got a daughter in Canberra and a daughter in Melbourne, so the poor girls are locked down. So we are relatively free here. I mean, we have to wear masks in many places, but and we've still got a limit of 10 people in the household. But, other than that, life's pretty good.
I'm glad. I can't wait to go to Adelaide. It's my next scheduled holiday, but I feel like I've got a lot of airline tickets floating around on vague extensions and all these holiday credits.
Oh, yeah. Find out where all our credits are. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. Dave, how are you doing?
Yeah, we're going pretty well, Kate. It's only the first few days of this next level lockdown, so certainly the closed playgrounds are ideal for our young family and getting some social outlet for the kids, and as well as Sarah and I catching up with other parents and friends down at the parks. But look, if we can get the Delta back down to zero in Melbourne without it taking too long, it'll certainly be worth it.
Yeah, that's what we're all hoping for, that's for sure. Now, today we're talking about an exciting topic, and it's exciting to have you, Dave, who can provide so much technical expertise about all of the nuts and bolts of this. But you, Pete, who's seen a lot of change, you've been an active property investor for decades. And I think in this particular space, we've seen enormous change. And we're chatting about how much can I borrow. But before we get into that, I'm going to ask you both for a quick market update.
There's a lot in the latest CoreLogic data about supply and demand. And I actually heard on the news last night, spokesperson for Domain saying that there was 1.4 sales for every new listing. You know, in simple terms, there are more properties being sold than new listings coming on. And I think I said in a podcast a couple of weeks ago, if nobody put property on the market from today, we'd run out of properties to sell in 7 months. So I don't want to go too much into detail into that. But what I do want to do is highlight one of the slides in the CoreLogic set. So it says residential real estate in total is worth $8.8 trillion. And outstanding mortgage debt is $1.9 trillion. Now, they're very, very big numbers. So if I bring it down to everyday numbers, it's like saying you've got an $880,000 house and your mortgage on it is $190,000. You know, for all those people that think that the property market's going to crash and stacks of people are going to go bankrupt, I think most people, if you owned an $880,000 house and you had a $190,000 mortgage and only one person was working, surely you could keep up the mortgage repayment. So for those scaremongers out there, when you look at the facts here, you know, on average, we're okay. Understandably, there will be some people that have much higher LVRs, and we're talking about that today, Dave. But the banks also use something called an assessment rate, which Dave is also going to talk about. So I think we certainly don't need to be scared that debts are rising too huge compared to the value in our real estate. Things are pretty comfortable at the moment.
Well, there we have it. That was a podcast. Thanks, Pete. We'll see you all next week.
See you next week.
It's a really good point. And I was actually thinking about the ratio myself as a point to chat about, because that is the highest that we've had in a long time. So it's a signal that our supply is very low compared to our demand. And it's interesting that so many of our population are in lockdown and their appetite is still up. I know in my own business, when I look at inquiry, when I look at the clients I'm currently working with, here in Melbourne, we can't do any inspections. So unlike our friends in Sydney who are still managing one-on-ones and they're still trading, we can't do that. And unless someone is prepared to let a vendor video the house and take them on a virtual walkthrough and then make a purchase decision on a sight unseen basis, we can't trade here in Melbourne. And we're trying not to sulk about it. We're hoping that it's just 2 weeks. Very difficult for vendors that do need to sell, but it's an interesting consideration. And one thing that surprised me that I saw this morning, one of my friends in Sydney in the BA space put up a chart that someone in-house had compiled for them, and it was tracking the number of daily cases in Sydney with the number of sales in the Northern Beaches, and it was a correlation. Just incredible. So the more the case numbers are growing, the more sales are taking place in the Northern Beaches, and I've not seen anything like that, but that just goes to show the power of being permitted to trade during a pandemic outbreak.
That's very interesting, Kate, because one of my master's students is doing their dissertation on the relationship between the number of COVID cases and residential property prices. And we've talked about that and we said, should you do it on cases? Should you do it on lockdowns? Should you do it on deaths? But he's going to try and he's going to do some statistical modelling to see if there is some sort of relationship between that. So in the Northern Beaches, you reckon there is. All right, I'll let that student
I'll send you the post. It was very clever.
Excellent.
I wonder what is causing that and if it's actually happening across broader Sydney or the Northern Beaches specifically, because there's very low number of cases there. It's obviously potentially a mini escape to the beaches instead of the regional area, because in theory people can't leave Sydney. Yeah, who knows what's driving that and if it is just Northern Beaches specific or whether it actually is broader across the rest of Sydney.
Yeah, and that's always the interesting thing about statistics. You've got to take into account other drivers. And look, it could just be a coincidence or a correlation of many. It could be coastal locations. It could be X kilometres out of Sydney. I'll be really interested to see this dissertation, Pete, because there are some very interesting relationships between COVID case numbers in the community and what's going on in property. And you might remember this time last year, well, a bit earlier actually, when I charted the prices that we secured properties for based on my appraised value. And then I constructed little houses on a chart that were differing in colour. Green was paid market price, orange was got up to a circa 5% discount, and red was circa 10% discount. And this was when COVID first hit and everyone freaked out. And it was a really interesting chart. So we can definitely delve into the data, and I'll look forward to chatting about that one, Pete. Dave, your market update.
Yeah, so my market update is the Time to Buy a Dwelling Index from Westpac Melbourne Institute that I've been sharing most months as it went on its highest run into November 2020, which is one of the early market indicators and one of the many reasons we felt like 2021 was going to potentially hit record numbers. Well, we've also now tracked its decline to below 100. And from July to August, it's actually had a sharp decline now of 8 points. So this is now the second lowest reading in the last 10 years. It's recorded at 88.9, dropping from 96.9. So this is going to, you know, it's usually been a pretty good forward leading indicator of what was likely to happen in the property market. So it suggests that certainly owner occupiers are feeling the heat and feeling like prices are getting too heady now for them to potentially upgrade or for first-time buyers to get into the marketplace. So it'll be interesting to see how much this plays out in reality. Obviously, it's still pretty strong on the ground, and I'm sure the advent of the Delta strain spreading across a lot of Australia, and obviously what's happening in Sydney, is having a pretty big impact on this index.
Yeah, very interesting. Anyone could argue that when we've got a little bit of fear and people stepping back, I've had a few prospects that had meetings with me saying, look, let's put it on hold. Understandable, they've made a decision that they're not comfortable right now to go into property. But then I've seen a lot of people that have learnt with all of this stop-start over the last couple of years, really, not hasn't just been COVID, with all of our market fluctuations and things that have given people a bit of fear, that when the rest of the pack are fearful, it can be a good time to buy. So I've had a few opportunistic buyers jump in saying, you know, let's go counter to the market and see what we can do. Difficult down here because we can't purchase without, well, we'd have to purchase without walking through a property. But in the regions, because our regions in Victoria are open, we've seen some really hefty bidding and, you know, very passionate efforts on the part of Melburnians to try and break into markets such as Geelong, Ballarat, Bendigo. And it's been a sight to behold, and sometimes it's pretty horrifying. I've been smashed online with auctions, but it's definitely a sign that there are still opportunistic buyers out there who are totally ready to do something.
Yeah, I think they're definitely out there. And one of the questions is, you know, what percentage of the people who are willing to buy and who have deep pockets are still thinking it's a good time to buy? Because, you know, the people who get interviewed for that index, a lot of them might be people who aren't even thinking about buying. There's going to be people who are generally a bit, you know, more pessimistic, you know. So it's a broader picture of a cross-section of society. So how relevant it is to investors in particular, what remains to be seen. So, but yeah, it's a good one to watch. And it certainly is interesting that it's as low as it's been in about 10 years.
Yeah, it's a great metric. We'll keep an eye on that one.
For all you budding property planners out there, at Property Planning Australia, we are looking to hire a new property planner. So if you live in Melbourne, have a passion for helping people make educated and superior property, mortgage and money management decisions, we would love to hear from you if you have at least 5 years of experience working as a fully qualified financial planner. If that sounds like you, please send us a copy of your CV to info@propertyplanning.com.au. You can also give us a call if you like on 1300 896 045.
Now, I'm going to jump us into our topic, and we're chatting about how much can I borrow. Dave, to kick things off, we've used a few buzzwords this morning. I'd love you to chat about the key differences between lenders when it comes to borrowing capacity, purchase price, and obviously assessment rates is a critical part of that. Over to you.
Yeah, so this episode came about on a long lunch on a Saturday with one of my senior strategic mortgage brokers, and he was testing me on what was the most common first question he got from clients. And over a bottle of red, he took great joy in me coming up with lots of suggestions, but not the actual first question, which was, how much can I borrow? So I was a bit slow to think of that. But it really is, you know, it's a vexed question. It's nuanced, it's layered, and it's not as simple as most people think. So I said to him, I reckon that'll be a great topic for our podcast. So there are many different moving parts to assessing your borrowing capacity. And today we just want to take you through some of those so you can help understand them for your own personal situation. And I guess get a better perception of how it can impact your lender choice when it comes to, particularly if you're looking to build a property portfolio. So I've broken it up really into assessment rates, variable incomes, interest only versus principal and interest, and how lenders' mortgage insurance impacts purchase price. So if we start with assessment rates, so what is an assessment rate? Basically, it's the rate that lenders use to stress test how much you can afford to borrow should rates rise. So you might be paying an interest rate of 2 or 3%, but the most lenders will be assessing your ability to repay on an interest rate of possibly one of the lowest at the moment is 5.05%. And it could be as high as 6 or 7%. So why do they do this? Well, the primary reason is if rates were to rise, but you plan to have a loan for 30 years. So unexpected events may happen during that term. Expected events may happen as well, such as having children. Yeah. You know, your income could reduce at times. You know, you're likely to change jobs over that period. You know, there could be illness. For every married couple, I think it's something like 40% or maybe 50% get divorced. So the reality is things change. So lenders need to assess what you can afford to repay based on an assessment rate that's much higher than your current actual interest rate you will be paying.
That's really now, interesting. Yeah. So just to recap in, you know, very basic lingo, if your actual interest rate, so what you're paying each month is somewhere between 2.5 and 3, let's say, you're talking about an additional 2.5% is what the banks calculate your ability to repay on. And sometimes we hear the word buffer, a buffer rate. That buffer is what you're talking about, that 2.5%. And I noted in your points, you know, the things that can change: reduction in income, unemployment, illness, divorce, future rate rises. And so many people say, oh, you know, if rates go up, you know, this will be a bloodbath or this will be messy. We're provisioning for rates going up. We're not saying that we expect them to, but it's provisioned for in the servicing.
Yeah, absolutely. It's provisioned for, and there are floor assessment rates. You know, they're mandated now by APRA for the banks, and that became, I guess, one of APRA's tools that they used 5 or 6 years ago when they were starting to slow down the growth of interest-only loans and investment loans. So as an example, you know, Westpac's floor assessment rate at the moment is 5.05%, which is one of the lowest. So if you are on a rate of 2.74% for an owner-occupied principal and interest loan, they'll then add 2.5% to that, which would make it 5.24%. So your assessment rate will be 5.24%, even though Westpac's floor rate is 5.05%. So they'll take the higher of the floor rate or your actual rate plus 2.5%. So this point alone can impact your borrowing capacity significantly, subject to the rate you're actually paying on your loan. If it's higher, then your assessment rate will be higher. And also the assessment rates vary from lender to lender.
I love this point. You've got some notes here about Citibank. And I think what's really critical for people to hear, without us going into so much detail that their heads spin, is when you do go to a strategic mortgage broker, if you're saying to them, I want to see what all of the lenders on your panel would be prepared to give me in terms of my credit worthiness and the policies that they've got, and in particular the borrowing capacity that's calculated, the borrowing capacities are different because they don't all follow the same policy and exactly the same formula. And so the benefit of sitting down with a strategic mortgage broker is that they can say, these policies are great, but they don't fit you and they don't suit you. And this particular lender, you might not have even been able to walk into a branch. It might be a branchless lender. There's a lender for everyone, and it's very hard for the inexperienced to know which one is going to get you where you need to go. And servicing is just one of the tiny number of many moving parts.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, at that initial point, you don't even know what products someone's going to select. You may not, they still may be deciding whether they're going to buy a stepping stone home or an investment property. So that obviously is going to change interest rates as well. Not to mention the fact that if you buy a home, your actual cash flow will be different to buying an investment property as well. So there are all these subtle detailed nuances that in just considering assessment rates, let alone some of the other factors that we'll come to, that you need to understand. And that's why one of the reasons why we talk about being clear on your strategy before selecting a lender, but it also is why just keying in how much you can borrow into an online calculator is definitely fraught with danger.
Now, I want to take a few steps down memory lane. Sorry to do this to you, Pete. We were chatting about this prior to recording, and I said to Pete, you know, back in the 70s and 80s, did they talk about assessment rates and buffer rates? And you kind of were drawing blanks. And you said, well, no. You'd go down to the bank and you'd meet the bank manager and you'd wear your best suit. And it was such a relationship-based way of lending money to people. And that was mostly because we didn't have a digitized world, and even if we did, we had a cash economy. So back then, your pay didn't go into your account, show up on your statement that gets downloaded to the lender and assessed in India. You got given a yellow pay packet with cash in it. I remember my dad counting out cash and giving mum her portion for the groceries. And if that was the economy that we had, how on earth could an assessment calculator work out what someone was capable of paying?
Just a quick reminder, you can access our show notes, including links to all of the resources we talk about, on our website, which is propertyplannerbuyerandprofessor.com.au.
So Pete, talk me through what it was like when it was a relationship-based decision and, you know, how you started your investment journey.
Sure. So Dave mentioned online calculators. You've got to remember back in the 80s when we bought our first house, there was no internet. You know, if you wanted to calculate what your mortgage would be, you got out your Casio calculator, the big bulky Casio calculator. If you were lucky, if not, you got the abacus out and you worked out what your repayments would be.
Dave's got it. I love it. That's the one.
There's his Casio.
And I like $100.
But you did have to get dressed up nicely to go see your bank manager. I remember, you know, regarding relationships and bank managers, like my dad was a real estate agent and he bought many properties. And the bank manager was almost like a family friend. I remember him coming to my 16th birthday party, to other family functions, because it was the bank, your local branch bank manager that decided whether you got the loan or not. Now, your application goes off to some faceless, nameless person somewhere, whether they're in Australia or not, to a department called credit, and then they determine whether you are eligible for the loan. So things have certainly changed in that space from being very much relationship-based, cash-based, as you mentioned, Kate. You know, it was very easy to hide things back then when it was all a cash economy. But now, you know, computers talk to each other, government departments talk to each other. So, you know, now we don't even get those end-of-year pay slips because the ATO knows automatically how much you earn every year. So I don't need to supply those pay slips to my accountant anymore. They just go to the ATO website and there it is. So, yeah, things have changed a lot, mainly due to digitisation, but also through the deregulation of the banking system in the late 80s and early 90s. So back then it was really the four major banks. That was it. But now, Dave, how many lenders could you borrow money from?
Look, it's probably something like 60, I would say. Right. Our panel of lenders, we've got sort of 40-odd. Yeah, so I would estimate it's around 60. All up across the country. So, yeah, it's a huge number. And, you know, I remember when I first got into mortgage broking in 1999 and my company didn't have a website and I didn't get my own email. You know, I think there was one email address for the five or six staff and I had to ring up the banks to clarify their product information and interest rates for my clients. You know, it wasn't available online. You know, no one knew what a mortgage broker was back then. Yeah. You had to explain what a mortgage broker was. So, and the number of lenders back then, oh, look, it might have been 15 or so. It was just starting to break out in the few years after that where many, many lenders started to pop up off the back of deregulation and, Aussie John probably.
Yeah. Our first home loan was with Westpac. And then we got an investment loan years later with NRMA, so back in the 90s. So, yeah, in the 90s is when things really did change a lot. Like the deposit requirements were basically 20%. Back when we bought our first home, there was no LMI, but then LMI came in the late 80s, and so you had the opportunity to pay lenders mortgage insurance with a reduced deposit. Mm. So, yeah, Kate, you know, as I'm the oldest one on this podcast, I do remember what things were like back then, not just reading them in a book, and things were very different.
I remember how progressive it felt when we could package a loan and send it straight to the lender as opposed to running down to Bourke Street because we had facsimile. And it would take ages to send.
Hey, do you remember in the dial-up tone of the internet back in the early days?
Sure do. Well, you've kind of segued us into LVR, Pete, nicely done. And we'll come back to you to chat about deregulation and some of the key personalities that changed things in lending forever for the better for us. But Dave, back to you, assessment rates and LVR.
Yeah, so banks have started to move towards pricing loans on risk. So making the interest rate higher, the riskier your loan is. And that's basically based on the loan-to-value ratio. So if your loan-to-value ratio, which is the proportion of your loan amount relative to your property value. So, for example, if your property is worth $1 million and your loan is $800,000, then that would be an 80% loan-to-value ratio. Once you borrow more than 80%, you're paying mortgage insurance. And so there are a number of lenders, and I think with open banking and credit scoring and the access of everyone's data more and more online, your interest rates are going to more and more be priced on your loan-to-value ratio and your credit score, rather than being able to pick and choose necessarily which loan and interest rate you're after. So that's already starting to happen, but I think that'll become much more prevalent over the coming 5 to 10 years. So if you're borrowing, say, 80 to 90%, then your interest rate is higher with many lenders. If you're borrowing 90 to 95%, it's higher again. And 95 to 98%, it's higher again. So some lenders will allow you to borrow 95% plus capitalizing, which means adding the mortgage insurance premium onto the loan. So this will also impact your borrowing capacity. With one lender, for example, if you're borrowing 80% or under, your interest rate would be 2.9%. If you're borrowing 80 to 90%, it would jump by 0.5, so it'd be 3.4. 90 to 95, it would be up at loan-to-value ratio. The interest rate would be 3.9%. And if you're right at the top tier of borrowing 95 to 98%, which some first-time buyers need to do, the interest rate would be 4.6%. So if you add 2.5% to the assessment rate for those, it varies between 5.4% for your assessment rate of how much you can borrow up to 7.1%. Now, on an average income of $80,000, an individual borrower, that can mean the difference between your borrowing capacity being around $600,000 at the top end or slightly under $500,000 at the bottom end. So that's a big differential of $100,000. And this is on, you know, an $80,000 income. Obviously, it would be greater the higher the income. So it can have a big impact on the property price that you're able to pay.
That's a really powerful chart and a powerful message, Dave. And I think that we need to talk about this a little bit more. So what the lenders are saying is you can go into higher LVR territory, meaning you're putting down less, you're risking a tiny, and well, you're giving the bank a tiny little bit of a guarantee and asking them to take a punt on you. They will do that. And there are lots of things that increase, and one of them is the assessment rate. So what they're saying is we need to see a lot more capacity to repay this than what we ordinarily would if you're in a lower risk category. And it just shows exactly how these intricate things all weave into each other, because we've talked about assessment rate, we've talked about LVR. When you combine the two, there is elasticity there, and the bank is saying we will make sure that we more than cover our risk so that we're satisfied with taking you into this high-risk territory.
Yeah, absolutely. And the same goes for if you're, you know, selecting some fixed-rate loans and some variable-rate loans, because they'll base the assessment rates mostly off the actual rate you're paying there. So there can be different assessment rates for the different loans. Some lenders will factor in the variable rate you're paying after the fixed rate period ends. So that's worth understanding, because they might be taking their standard variable rate, which is a lot higher than the actual, you know, professional package discounted rate that you might receive. So also the product choice and whether it's fixed or variable can also have an impact on your overall borrowing capacity too.
Very much so. And what I would like to ask you is, when someone is high risk and they're looking at a much higher degree of leveraging, so they're going into LMI territory, and let's say it's a 95 LVR, are they also applying not just a higher assessment rate, but are they applying higher actual rates?
Yeah, so often the actual rates will be higher. So that example is a lender where the actual interest rate is higher. So at that top end, you're paying an interest rate of 1.7% higher.
Yeah.
With that lender, your interest rate is 2.9% at 80% or below. At the top end, 95 to 98%, which not many lenders offer anymore, your interest rate is 4.6%.
Yeah, it's expensive. So yeah, you can get your money, but you absolutely have to pay for it.
Yeah, exactly. So the lender's taking on more risk and they're getting you to pay for it through your interest rate. And also your mortgage insurance premium.
Of course. Now let's chat about that, because I asked Pete last night, when did LMI come about and what was your understanding of it? And interestingly, Pete started his property journey in the 80s and, you know, had his 20-something percent deposit and met the bank manager. And there was no talk of LMI. That's because it wasn't around. It wasn't a mainstream thing then. Pete, talk to me about that.
Yeah, so again, relationships were very important back then. 20% was it. The relationship you had with your manager was really important. I mentioned before that our first home loan was with Westpac. For some reason, I don't know why, the fact that my sister-in-law worked for Westpac worked in our favour. It wasn't like some nudge, nudge, wink, wink deal under the table, but genuinely, the fact that she worked for Westpac did help. So, yeah, things were very different back then. And then we moved to the other extreme in the late 90s, early 2000s, where, and we've talked about this before, Dave, like low doc and no doc lines. We go from one extreme to the other, and then we went back again just recently with this, all this forensic checking by the banks, but now they're loosening up a little bit. So it certainly does go through cycles. And that 20% deposit, like people listening now think, geez, that was huge. But when you look at how much deposit people around the world have to come up with for their first home, 20% is quite reasonable. You know, we are quite lucky that in theory you can get a home with just a 5% deposit. Yeah, we are quite fortunate about that.
We are indeed. Now, a lot changed in the late 80s, and you talked about it before, Pete. And the reason I'm going back to this is I'm going to augment the first half and the second half of our material to end on this note today, because we've got such an exciting array of other facets to share with our lenders. We're going to do part B for how much can I borrow. And today we're going to finish our podcast on reflecting on the changes that came about in the late 80s with deregulation, and in particular, the action of one individual that you mentioned you knew a bit about, Pete, John Symond. So I'm going to ask you to talk about what happened in the late 80s and what role he played.
Yeah, so he was a pioneer. So before that, it was just the major banks. And even before that, we didn't have banks. Like back in the 60s, when my dad was borrowing money, you had to go to rich individuals to borrow the money. There wasn't these retail banks that we have now. But John was certainly a pioneer where there was in very simple English, you could go to a company or an organisation and they could find the best loan for you. We used to have insurance brokers back then and who were doing similar things, and now we have mortgage brokers. So rather than just going to Westpac to find out what they can do for you, go to NAB to find out what they can do for you, you go to one organisation. Back then it was Aussie Home Loans, and they could do all the work for you to find the best loan for you. If I could just give you a quick personal story that I have about Aussie John. Now, I never met Aussie John, but back in the 90s when I was a primary school teacher, a current affair show called Today Tonight had a competition where to see what you could do with $1,000. So they gave $1,000 to my year seven class, to a professional gambler, to a single mum, and to Aussie John. And we had a year to see what we could do with that money. Cut a long story short, one of the activities that we did, and I don't think you would be allowed to do it now, but we renovated a property. So one of the kids in the class, they had a relative that was selling, and we worked out what the property was worth now. And then we said, all right, any price increase because of our renovation, we'll go 50-50. So it was a very, very valuable lesson for the kids. Unfortunately, we didn't make any money because it was 1999 when really the property market stopped because everyone was scared what was going to happen with the introduction of the GST. But nevertheless, very valuable lesson. And in the end, unfortunately, the professional gambler won. He made more money with his $1,000 than we did.
But lost it all in the Cayman Islands?
That's a little aside story. But yeah, look, Aussie John was a... We use the term now game changer. He was a real game changer in the banking and finance industry. And thanks to him, we have organisations such as Dave's where you can go to a person who can do all the legwork for you and find you the best loan based on your strategy and your circumstances.
Amazing. That's a very cool story. No, I can't imagine finding 30 hard hats and getting parents to sign all those permissions.
There were no high-vis vests back then either.
That's fantastic. I love it. How involved were you in the renovation all the years?
I was there. Like, we were washing down walls. We were doing gardening. I mean, the parents were there as well. Like, I'm not going to let 12-year-old kids paint a house.
Yeah.
But basically it was painting, landscaping and new floor coverings, which is what you would do for a basic reno anyway if you're looking to make money. The carpet people came in and did the carpet. We did a lot of the cleaning up, like getting rid of rubbish, planting stuff.
This relative would have been saying, this is amazing. This is so cool.
A lot of free labour for the
child labour, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, that's a good story. Dave, as we say cheerio to our listeners, can you just give us a quick overview of what they can expect for part two of How Much Can I Borrow?
Yeah, so part two, we'll talk about variable income. So from my experience, I would say something like 8 out of 10 people have some sort of variability in their income, whether it's commissions, bonuses, overtime, what have you. So we'll talk about that because that's very different from lender to lender. We'll talk about the differences and how interest only versus principal and interest can impact your borrowing capacity, and also how lender's mortgage insurance can impact your purchase price, among other things.
Oh, that sounds so good. And we'll talk about first tier lenders, second tier lenders, third tier or non-banks. We'll have a bit of fun. So it's always a joy to hang out with you guys. Have you got your gold nuggets ready?
If you've enjoyed our podcast, leave a review on iTunes and share the episode with your friends.
Now it's time for us to go mining for our gold nugget property tip of the day.
Pete, you are up.
Okay, so my gold nugget is, even though I'm old as I am and I know a little bit about property, I actually learned something new today. Thank you very much, Dave. I didn't realise that as you increased your LVR, your actual interest rate also increased. So when you see these headline rates, 2%, well, that assumes your loan-to-value ratio is, for example, below 80%. If you're going in with 90 and 95%, don't hope that you're going to get a 2% interest rate. You really need to speak to your strategic mortgage broker to work out what is the best product for you based on how much deposit you have and what your goals are.
Nice one.
That varies from lender to lender. And not all lenders will allow you to borrow 95 to 98. And, some won't allow you to borrow above 80% for investment loans, for example. Some will go to 90% for investment loans. Some won't allow you to pay interest only on owner-occupied loans above 80%. So there's all these
lots
little
of
nuances.
Dave, what's yours?
My gold nugget is when you're looking to borrow, whether it's refinancing or purchasing, take the time to listen to and understand the factors that go into determining your borrowing capacity. A lot of people don't take the time to understand those nuances, and it could cause frustration with the process. Whereas if you actually understand what's causing the outcomes for you, then I think it can educate and empower you to have more say in the lender you select, probably keeping your strategic mortgage broker or whoever you're using more accountable as well to make sure that they're providing you with good quality advice. And so a little tip that I would suggest is ask them to send you a copy of the borrowing capacity serviceability calculator that they have completed, or ones that they've completed, because a good strategic mortgage broker should be completing a number of them, for you to look through. And you can actually, because at the end of the day, they're just an Excel spreadsheet with numbers input into them. But you can go through each of the cells and actually understand the impact of the numbers and how your income's used and the assessment rates within those cells. And you will much better understand how your borrowing capacity is determined and therefore the impact it has on your property strategy or your refinancing strategy.
That's a great tip. I remember the first time I got my hands on a lending calculator and I had a lot of fun with it. I was able to pave out some strategies. It was exciting.
Was it a Casio cake?
No, it was actually when the internet was about, and my mortgage broker kindly gave me access to their servicing calculator, and it explained why lots of things or a yes or a no, because if you don't understand the context, it's very hard to have it all explained. As you're saying today, just unpacking a few of them, they're all interlinked and there's so many variables.
Yeah, it's a great differentiator between a quality strategic mortgage broker and someone else and their ability to massage the serviceability calculator.
So true. Now, guys, we've hit a bumper edition number of minutes for this one. So we're going to give our listeners a break and sign off and promise them that Part B will be full of juicy tips and tricks as well.
See you all next week.
See you later.
Bye-bye. Bye.
If you've enjoyed this episode and would like to learn more about how an effective mortgage strategy is critical to wealth creation, take a listen to episodes number 9, Why Your Mortgage Strategy is More Important Than Your Interest Rate. Episode 24, How Mortgage Strategy Shapes Your Ability to Hold Property and How It Can Pay Off for Decades to Come. Episode 30, Money Management, 7 Steps to Success. Episode 34, No Mortgage Strategy, number 4 of the top 7 critical mistakes. Episode 48, Offset Accounts, God's Gift to Mortgage Strategy. And finally, Episode 87, Optimizing Tax Deductions, Top Mortgage and Loan Strategy Tips.
Thank you for joining the property planner, David Johnston, whose company Property Planning Australia provides the only independent pure planning advisory in Australia that does not buy or sell property, insurance, investment or super products.
And the property buyer, Kate Bacos, recently awarded Buyer's Agent of the Year and an owner of an independent buyer's agency in Melbourne's Inner West. And of course, the property professor, Peter Kalizos, Australia's leading property university lecturer, Chairman of Property Investment Professionals of Australia and seasoned investor and developer.
We've really enjoyed delivering this podcast and we'd love you to join us on our podcast webpage at propertyplannerbuyerandprofessor.com.au or our Facebook page. Feel free to send us any questions and Dave, Pete and I will answer them for you.
So until next time, remember that each property decision you make is leading you towards your ideal lifestyle.
Everything we talk about in this episode is general in nature and should not be considered to be financial advice. We've put a lot of effort into making sure the information is accurate, but please don't rely on this information to make a decision. If you're looking for specific advice, please seek the help of a specialist and remember, it's important you determine your trusted advisors are independent.